We might think of science as clinical, but as far as scientists are concerned, there is still beauty to be found in the patterns that explain our world. Hi, I'm Isabella Rossellini, and in the latest episode of This Is Not a Beauty podcast, we'll hear from scientists and researchers about how beauty has spurred innovation and discovery. Listen now on your favorite podcast platform.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your dubs in the chat of music, news, and criticism, and sometimes beyond that. I'm John Caramonica, a critic at the New York Times.
I'm Joe Coscarelli, a reporter at the New York Times.
How about that? Great things to be. Joe, at the beginning of this episode, we are listening to a song that I think we're going to be hearing a lot in the next 4 years. That is God Bless America, Mar-a-Lago version. This was sung a few nights ago at a gathering, as were all the gatherings of the Republican elite and potentially post-Republican elite are hanging out. Donald J. Trump, the presumptive 47th president of the United States, on stage singing along. Elon Musk, richest man in the world, on stage singing along, embracing America. Or embracing a song. That's what culture is starting to look like and maybe will look like for the next 4 years. We have already lived through one Trump administration. And there have
Remember
been
that?
I did. Yeah, I was in my teens, maybe. And there are things that I remember culturally from that administration. I remember the slight hardening of the right wingification of certain corners of Nashville. I remember that weird edict that all new government buildings should be built using classical architecture styles as opposed to modernism or postmodernism, which didn't seem to take effect.
Now, how are the architects doing in the wake of the election?
I feel like maybe that's a 2.0. If you're an architect and you listen to podcasts, email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Let us know how you're feeling. Trump is back. Trump's America is back. And it's got me thinking, what is culture going to look like in the second Trump administration? And I mean that on two different planes. One, what is the organic culture that comes from that world? What does it look like? What does it sound like? What are the values? What are the cultural touch points? The second thing is, what of that seeps across ideological divides and actually spreads? And I'm loath to use the term mainstreamed because I think you could contend, potentially, that the mainstream is that culture. That is what is the centrist culture happening in American culture right now. That I don't know the answer to that question. I imagine it's a moving target, but it is something to consider. And I think often in the media, there is this presumption that if people are talking about it in certain media outlets, that is the center of culture, popular culture, ideological approaches or whatnot. And maybe that's not always the case. And this is going to be an interesting 4 years for seeing what the give and take is across the ideological spectrum. Your top line thoughts about the give and take.
My top line thought is that often the culture of a presidential administration, a moment in time, is hard to see at the moment while it's happening, often is only clear in the rear view and takes a while, I think, to really take hold.
To seed
in the sense that there's a universe in which what we're talking about now happening because Trump won the election was actually what was happening in these past few years under Joe Biden.
Finally manifesting.
And that this is, that the election results, you know, that map where all the arrows, all the red arrows are pointing in one direction.
Pew.
Except like in the Atlanta suburbs, weirdly.
And like Colorado.
Yeah.
Just vibing.
That's the culture.
I would like to hear from the music critic of the Denver, what's the Denver newspaper?
The Denver Post.
I'd love to hear from the music critic of the Denver Post. Just see what the vibes are like in that area.
Right. And so I think like what we lived under in the Joe Biden administration was actually a representation of Trump culture. You know what I mean? And I think, I mean, looking back, New York Magazine, Vulture, they did a great package sort of in the lead up to the election about what they called Obamacorps. And it was only in 2024, maybe, that you could really see what it was like between 2008 and 2016, this, you know, the time of Glee and 1989. And I thought a really evocative one was like Louis C.K. playing a cop on Parks and Recreation. Like, there's no more like Obama era line than that, you know, but you need to look at it in the rear view. So I think it's helpful that we had a Trump administration, then we had a break in which that culture was dormant or silent majority-ish. And now we'll get to see it rear its head back up in a more, let's call it, you know, forceful way.
Right.
And so I think that a lot of this stuff has been bubbling for a really long time, all of which is to say, meaning Morgan Wallen.
Well, sure. Of course.
Has been really popular.
For a really long time.
For a really long time.
Okay, so I'm interested in, like I said, that level of culture, which is sort of organic to right-leaning communities, but I'm also interested in these moments where they cross out into these broader spaces. So we're recording this on a Monday. Yesterday was a Sunday, which was the NFL. And there were, I believe, three instances of a receiver catching a touchdown pass and then doing the Trump dance as the celebration, the Trump little shimmy, this kind of like arrhythmic, rhythmic shimmy that he does. John Jones, the UFC fight, same thing, had a knockout, did the Trump dance. There was also the Nick Bosa thing.
Which was before the election.
Yes, and also wearing the MAGA hat. And I was maybe less surprised on a micro level that someone like a receiver would do that dance. I mean, you know, everything's a meme now. Like, things have been largely stripped of.
Did you see the Ray Gun frame by frame recreation touchdown
dance?
Yes,
I did. Yes, I did. Very good. So I was maybe
apolitical.
It's apolitical. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, except it's pro breakdancing. it's pro keeping the culture alive of breakdancing. So I wasn't necessarily surprised to see people doing the dance, but apparently at least some of the media operations of the football teams either did not share clips of that, or there was at least one example of someone being asked about the dance in a post-game press conference, and then that clip got disappeared in memory hold from the internet.
Right, and being sort of shoved away, like, press conference is over.
Right.
And
so that, to me, these ruptures are interesting. There's two ruptures. One, it's the rupture of a dance breaking out into a ostensibly non-partisan space. We can say the NFL is partisan or not. Like, let's say, for the purpose of this conversation, it's a non-partisan space. And then the corporate interest of the NFL or the individual team saying, actually, no, we're gonna tie this up before it gets ugly. How often are they going to be able to do that? It's not there. Every team is going to do that every week for the rest of the season.
Even the attempts. I mean, this is how you know that Trump culture is ascendant, because even the attempts to be like, no, we don't normalize that, are fewer and further between, and they're less forceful than they used to be. I think like the Bosa example is an interesting one. You know, we're talking about the San Francisco 49ers, but you don't need to know the specifics of what's going on in these sports to take the cultural impact away. But basically, there's a post-game conference a couple weeks ago ahead of the election, and he pops on the screen and is basically photobombing with his Make America Great Again hat. He gets a fine for that. And then Trump wins the election, and then he does the dance to basically be like, you can't stop me.
Yes.
Like, we won. Like, what are you going to do? If this would have been on the, if the shoe would have been on the other foot, I think he's arguing, or at least insinuating, like, I never would have heard about this, but you can no longer act like this stuff is off limits. And I think that that's a huge...
That's a shift.
And that's like the turn in the argument, which is, you know, we've heard a lot of conversation. We're going to get into Trump appearing on podcasts. A lot of conversation about platforming versus deplatforming. Should liberals be going on Fox News? Should liberal candidates be going on Joe Rogan? Do the liberals need their own Joe Rogan, or do they need to interact with the Rogan we have at home. Like, the, you know, we have Joe Rogan at home. You two can go on Joe Rogan. And I think, like,
do you think AOC should come on podcast?
Sure. And yeah. I think that so should JD Vance.
Great.
Who famously had a lot of playlists.
And also like an emo phase.
Yeah, maybe. He's a big Garden State guy.
Yeah.
According to his old blog.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anytime, both. Either, both.
Together.
Together. But I think that, you know, if you think back to 2016, like right after Trump won, remember like Mike Pence went to go see Hamilton and it was like a huge blow up.
Yes. And they were, like, we can't, no fascists.
They spoke to him like from the stage. Like, this really happened. Like, this really happened. And then Trump demanded they apologize for breaking script to address the fact that Mike Pence was there.
To be clear, he cares about the integrity of art.
Yeah, sure.
Classical.
But I just think, like, those are no longer, those conversations are from 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're going to have to rapidly move into a new phase.
That's okay. So let's talk about some of the things that led to this softening.
Right.
One thing that I was thinking about a lot looking at, and forgive me, I literally can't believe I'm going to use this phrase, but like looking at media Twitter in the months leading up to the election, one thing that I feel like I was seeing more and more were people engaging with Trump less as obviously a figure they do not wish to be president, and more of, dare I say, a softer figure, someone who they were admitting to the comedy in. They were attuned to his tics in a way that suggested they were less maybe preoccupied in the immediate short term with policy and more and willing to see him as a figure of culture. That softening felt, that level of discourse felt very different to me than the conversation around him, certainly during his first term or even leading up to his first term.
Yeah, and I think that's another thing that was happening, especially after the 2020 election. And there was a moment, which I think a lot of the political coverage has harped on, where it felt like the left had vanquished
right
Trump, and that
they
now
thought of him in the past tense,
and that now a lot of liberals could say, you know, like, now that we're like, I got to admit, mm-hmm, pretty funny, like Bulls. some good memes, you know, at 7 it's marginal, like, mm-hmm, we can watch the Christmas clip like over and over again without feeling guilty about it, because mm-hmm, we're no longer normalizing.
Right. It was the notion that the Trump presidency was a glitch in American history, mm-hmm, and normalcy had been restored. And like you say, you could look in the rear view and say, okay, I can cherry pick something that maybe makes me feel a little bit better about that time, rather than an acknowledgement that actually potentially the first and now the incoming second Trump presidency represents something much broader for democracy and for the state of the United States, and also recalibrates who is maintaining the power of cultural decision making.
Right.
So that, to me, I'm most interested, I think, in the coming months, especially of the, I guess maybe the term would be leakage. What is the leakage from MAGA universe into everyone else who was saying, I wish to have no part of this, and then maybe softened slightly?
Hey, it's John Chase.
And Mari Uehara.
From Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. Mari, it is gift-giving time, which means I am hopeless and need help.
You're not alone. John, we have over 40 gift guides, like gifts for people who love food. I really love this butter warmer on that list.
I didn't even know these existed.
It's this cute enamelware pot. If you're someone like me who explodes butter in your microwave, you can melt butter in it, but you can use it for a ton of other stuff. Making hot chocolate, warming soup, and it looks great on the stovetop.
This is useful, but it's also good looking.
Yeah, definitely.
What's an easy gift for someone like under $50?
So in our gifts under 50 guide, we have this super cute palm-sized Bluetooth speaker. It comes in an array of cool colors. It's waterproof. I want one for my garden.
Terrific. For all of Wirecutter's gift ideas and recommendations, head to nytimes.com/holidayguide.
Trump and the campaign seemingly leaned into this, let's just let him be a meme,
yes,
thing, and we're lent the stage on which to do that by a sort of just subterranean alternative mainstream.
And also, I would actually say not subterranean, right. I would say alt-terranean.
Sure.
You know, to the thing that when I was looking up the numbers, and I wrote a piece about Manosphere podcasters and Trump's appearances on those shows, partially because I felt like people were alluding to them but had not actually watched them, and I thought it was important to watch them and say, well, what are we seeing, and what am I seeing, and therefore what are millions and millions and millions of Americans seeing? That was important. But one of the things that I had in a version of the piece and I took out was after each show, I was just like, you know, X million followers or X million views. And when you look at those numbers, they don't seem so subterranean. They're maybe subterranean in the sense that they don't appear on Jimmy Fallon or Jimmy Kimmel, or they don't appear on NPR or so on and so forth. But from a size perspective, it is an alternative media. And there was that, I'm not remembering who said this, but someone on the right-wing side the night of the election sort of was like looking over like the Daily Wire and all these folks, and he was like, you are the media now. And, you know, here we are in this building and being like, you know, I don't know. But that's really like that's a potentially legitimate and viable perspective. And so it's not subterranean. It's alt-terranean to me. And those shows have millions of followers and also hundreds of millions of aggregated views. And one of the things that we talked about a couple of months ago on Popcast, the Harris campaign went in a totally different direction. The Harris campaign was basically like, when was it last sunshine in America? Who was famous? Let's remind people of that. Let's remind people of Oprah. Let's remind people, I mean, you don't need to remind anyone of Taylor Swift, but let's bring those, all
Lady
those,
Gaga, Lady Katy Gaga, Perry.
You might need to remind people of Katy Perry, but let's bring people back to that feeling. And then if we can access that feeling and trigger it, then maybe they'll apply that feeling to this candidate. Trump obviously is denied access to any of that. He doesn't know, none of those people would take him seriously. None of them would take the phone call. You know, his celebrity ecosystem is, scattershot, as it were.
Right. And we talked about some of the people who did, you know, gangster rappers.
Yes.
Has been gangster mm-hmm. rappers mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, but also present day drill artists, mm-hmm. You know, people who were pardoned by him, a la Kodak Black. You know, somebody who loves attention and maybe isn't getting as much of it as he used to, like a Lil Pump, or a Waka Flocka Flame. Like mm-hmm. these things are happening. You always have the Kid Rocks and the sort of, you know, extra outlaw modern country stars.
Outlaw trademark.
Yeah.
TM.
Yeah. Yeah. But I wonder what you make of people who want to look back over cultural trends from the last 2 to 4 years and say that actually this was proof. You know, you see this tongue-in-cheek, but also earnestly, where everyone's like, we should have known when Beyonce went country. We should have known when the Hawk Tua girl became a celebrity mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden had one of the most popular podcasts in the world. We should have known, right? We should have known when Morgan Wallen ruled the charts, even though
podcast Tua.
Yeah, like Post Malone mm-hmm. going country. Like, were these harbingers? I mean, even the popularity of UFC, like you mentioned John Jones and this event over the weekend where Trump, Elon, Kid Rock, Dana White, they're all together and they're saying like, here we are at the top of the world. Like, UFC isn't more popular this weekend than it was 2 weekends ago.
Right. I think a lot about the oxygen that Trump and his compatriots was denied in the post 2020. It's not as if, you know how like normal politics goes, where it's like the Republicans lose, but it's like everybody gets a soft landing. They get their CNN commentary job, even like one or two on MSNBC, a bunch go to Fox News, people go lobbying. It's like everybody had a soft landing. The Trump organization in 2016 and 2020, no one was like welcoming those people with open arms. I mean, obviously some of them end up on the old standard networks, but by and large, a lot of people who Trump employed, people were saying, no, we're keeping this in arm's length. And so what happened
unless they started speaking out explicitly against him.
Right.
And then
exactly,
they were welcomed into those spaces.
Correct. And so what happens is at the same time, there's like a cycle of funding of right-wing politically focused media outlets. There is the expansion of the podcast space where you need no buy-in in order to start just making a YouTube show. Everybody should have a YouTube show as far as I'm concerned. And so all of a sudden there is oxygen for those figures. And from the outside looking in, it might have seemed like, oh, well, that's like the dying. That's a signs of a dying empire. It was a glitch, and these are the last gasps of the glitch. And instead, what it was the aggregation of a lot of loose energy that needed a home. And then it formalized it. Like, you can think what you want about the Rogan interview of Trump, the Theo Von interview of Trump, the Bussin' with the Boys interview with Trump. What that did is it put Trump in front of millions of people. It wasn't random and it wasn't arbitrary. There are millions of people in those spaces who were there, receptive and waiting for a message from this person. That's why those things worked. And to me, as far as like Beyonce going country, Post Malone going country, I'm a little less in on that as far as like the temperature of the United States of America. But I do think, like, from a UFC, like, all of this stuff existed. These slots existed. They just didn't have a key. And Trump comes along and says, I can provide the key. And then all of a sudden, all that stuff looks almost as legitimate as all the things that people are trained to think of as legitimate.
I think in the wake of 2016, there was a real moment of reckoning and looking in the mirror by mainstream media, the New York Times included or chief among them, that was sort of like, we need to get into the diners. We need to get into the coal mines. You know, this is where, honestly, where J.D. Vance came from. This is where Hillbilly Elegy was held up as a sort of window into this thing that we ignored. Mm-hmm. And that felt like it was on, right or wrong, you know, agree with it as a tactic or not, that felt like it was on a citizen level. And it felt, you know, like liberals on the coast were like, we just didn't even know that these people existed. Like we never opened our eyes or our hearts to them. And I think, and it was quite, it was heavy. There was a gravitas to this sort of soul searching. Again, whether or not you think it was earnest or valid or not. And now I think what you're seeing is a little bit less of a, we didn't know these people existed, to we didn't take their media and their culture seriously.
Yes, correct.
And now, instead of saying we weren't aware of these people, we were like, liberals are saying we shouldn't have written off the spaces in which they act silly.
Well, this
it's a podcast or an Ultimate Fighting Championship.
And this was sort of the main thing that I was most interested in trying to watch these shows is I did not go into what. All right, so I'm going to list all the ones that I watched. There were actually a couple I didn't watch. I didn't watch the one with the Undertaker. Or no, it was my bad.
Yeah, where's your wrestling? You have a huge blind spot.
Sorry.
WWE.
I'm taking a 6-month sabbatical to school up on professional wrestling.
Vince McMahon is proto Trump culture.
Yeah, so I need to be better prepared for the next 4 years. So the Joe Rogan Experience, Theo Von show, which is called This Past Weekend, Andrew Schultz's show, which is called Flagrant, the Nelk Boys did a full Send episode, and they also did a vlog on Trump Force One, Bussin' with the Boys, which is a pair of ex-football players, Break 50, which is Bryson DeChambeau, who's like one of the best current golfers, and then, of course, the Aiden Ross live stream. I didn't go into any of those things expecting policy conversation. There were like bits and pieces of policy conversation. And one thing about Trump is he does go on autopilot quite a lot. So I think if he senses an opening
to do the stump speech.
Yeah, like essentially
the weave of the stump speech.
Right. And especially like a weakness, dare I say, in the host, he can just steamroll with stump. But I was curious, and I think the thing that really sent me down this path was the Theo Von episode and the clips that were circulating. I truly think that, you know, you're loath to be like any one specific moment like tilts the election, because that's not how elections work. But the conversation that Theo Von had with Trump about cocaine use and even just
drugs and alcohol in
general. Just in general, and Theo Von talking about how there's something in the cocaine that's causing a rattle and it'll have you on your porch like an owl, and Trump seeming like genuinely concerned and destabilized and maybe like 10% like, why am I sitting here? Like, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. But also like Trump's family, there's family history with addiction.
He was quite gingerly using it as a way to tease out elements of Trump's biography that he often glosses over. He talks about his brother being an alcoholic and his, you know, his relationship with his father. But Theo Von was like teasing more and more out of him by honestly using the deflective tactics of a comedian, which Theo Von is.
Yes. And also, I thought Trump was maybe even using the opportunity to look and be a little reflective for himself and say, I don't get to talk to people who have experienced this much. And I actually do have a curiosity about what that was like, what that might have been like for my brother, and what that might have been like for this individual in front of me. Let me at least ask. You don't see Trump ask a lot of questions. And one of the interesting things about these shows, particularly Theo Von and to a lesser degree Flagrant and the Bustin' with the Boys show, is Trump asked a lot of questions. And you don't necessarily experience him as like a person of curiosity when you see speeches and when you see the tweets or the Truth Social posts. You don't experience them that way. But it was quite striking that in moments, there was a softening, a relaxing of the guard and relaxing of the stump speech, and then a tiny bit of curiosity comes out. And I think if you are a young person, probably for this case, mostly young men, watching this, that's that version of Trump is that's your primary entry point. You're seeing that. You're not seeing a person on stage delivering rants. You're not seeing a person on stage saying things that a lot of people find politically very, very itchy and hard to work with. You're seeing a person who can hang with the guys. And that is what I think the aggregate effect of these shows was, is it showed a new generation of people. He's just like us.
That's an interesting wrinkle, because I do continue to find, even in these spaces, Trump to be not actually one of the guys. He's quite coastal. He's quite
the suit's great.
Flamboyant. Yeah. You know, he's quite unique. You know, there are just as many people who will point to his love of like Les Mis. and what, like, he definitely knows more about Les Mis than he knows about NFL football.
Yes, but he may know more about golf than he knows about Les Mis. Although, sure. You know,
golf, I think, is yes. Where he is, where he does have a lot in common with the common men. Yeah, the common bro. But I also think that there is an awkward fit for him there, because he's just a weird guy. And I think there's a lot of weird guys in this new coalition, in this cohort. And I think it's not a coincidence that it dovetails with comedy. And the thing that I think they have in common, and this brings us back to the question of what was culture during the Trump term and then the in-between Biden term and now again. And I think a lot of what these people were responding to is being told that they couldn't say things. And I think that that's the most obvious common cause is between a bunch of aspiring and or successful stand-up comedians. Yep. And Donald Trump, another aspiring stand-up comedian.
That's true. Actually, though.
And I think that middle ground, and that's where you bring in a lot of disaffected men who maybe don't even have that much interest in politics, but are saying, you know, Tony Hinchcliffe before the election and the Madison Square Garden rally, making a bad joke about Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. Like, that, as much as that might have alienated voters, I think it just as often brings people in to say, finally, like, this guy says whatever he wants. He gives us the leeway to say things we used to be able to say and that now liberals want us to stop saying. So I do wonder if one of the things we've seen in this sort of retraction and expansion of culture in the identity politics era is that this next Trump term is going to be a time when anyone can say anything or do like there are fewer guardrails or self-imposed guardrails about who can say what and how.
It's Melissa Clark from New York Times Cooking, and I'm in the kitchen with some of our team. Nikita Richardson, what are you making for Thanksgiving this year?
I'm making the cheesy Hasselback potato gratin, featuring layers of thinly cut potatoes. Very easy, but it's a real showstopper.
Genevieve Coe, what about you?
I'm actually doing a mushroom Wellington puff pastry wrapped around this delicious savory mushroom filling, arguably as stunning, if not more so, than a turkey.
No matter what kind of Thanksgiving you're cooking, you can find the recipes you need at nytcooking.com/Thanksgiving.
And I also wonder that the sort of 2.0 of that is, if I'm a programming executive at Netflix or NBC or whatever, am I going to look at, I got to replace Kimmel in 3 years. I got to replace Fallon in 5 years. Like, am I looking at one of these guys? Am I looking at Schultz? Am I looking at Vaughn to take over accounts like that? And saying effectively you can do a version of whatever it is you are already doing. Is that really where things are going? That to me is a bit of a head scratch. I wonder, this came up in a meeting that we had here last week where we're talking about like the aesthetics of the YouTube guys. And someone was asking me in the meeting, like, did I think the aesthetics of the YouTube, of the YouTubers would change as more eyeballs went to them and more money rolled in and so on and so forth. And I was like, no, I actually think the bigger thing is I think mainstream outlets, mainstream cable, broadcast, are going to say, well, these other people are getting way more attention than us at a far lower budget. Why are we spending all this money? Actually, we should like change our P&Ls and figure out how to make things that are feel more lo-fi and feel more approachable. I think that's much more likely than the other way around.
Don't you think that those people are also taking from something like a Vice, which I think
you mean the podcasters?
Yeah, which I think occupies an interesting space. Like back to the Obama era, you sent me a link earlier from Semaphore, in which they were saying that Shane Smith, the founder of Vice, who's trying to make a comeback, wants to bring conservatives onto his show and is telling them, like, no, like that liberal dance we were doing, like that was just for show. Like
Disney.
Yeah, that was for our corporate partners. Like we've always been more freewheeling than that. Of course, another co-founder of Vice,
Gavin McGinnis, the founder of the Proud Boys.
But I do think there was a lot of that DIY energy and spirit in what might have once been considered the liberal media.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was co-opted or borrowed or whatever, and the left slipped back into glossy, mainstream, zeitgeist, the stuff we're talking about, and sort of left, ceded that ground to the right. And I think that's a lot of what you've seen cheerleading on the right is like, we're the punks.
Yes.
We're the cool. You don't have a monopoly on cool or fame anymore. Like that's our stuff. And I think you're seeing a big exhale from even the people who wanted to exist in both places, the NFL players, for instance, who thought, okay, we play in the NFL. This is a huge jingoistic billion-dollar pro-military corporation, but also it says end racism in the end zone. Mm-hmm. So I have to be on both sides of these line. And now I think you're having a lot of people, you know, call it what it is, like a mask off moment where they say, oh, like I thought I had to keep this stuff to myself, but in fact I don't. And we see that in the streets.
Well, it reminds me of a TikTok I saw the other day of filmed by a guy who was walking the streets of New York wearing a MAGA hat.
Yeah.
And like, you know, we walk the streets of New York quite a bit. We don't really see MAGA hats that much. Certainly not prior to 2 weeks ago. And he's filming, and I assume it's surreptitiously he's filming. People are like giving him fist bumps and sort of being like, ah, finally, you know, it's
it goes back to the guy, the meme on the plane where the guy obviously wants people to comment on his shirt.
Yes. And so there was that. And then there was another video I saw of kind of like the kind of pickup truck flying two Trump flags that you would see on social media from the South or the Midwest, but driving through the heart of Los Angeles and people like honking at it and so on and so forth. Mask off is I think the right phrase for it. It's people who now feel emboldened. I also imagine part of the emboldening has to do with a lot of the politics of the last year of what's been happening in the Middle East and people being vociferous on both sides and that sort of spilling out into larger political discourse. It feels like it's all of a piece.
Remember Kanye West?
Japan is lovely this time of year. I wonder what you thought, to the extent that you watched, of both the aesthetics and the interviewing skills or styles of the people who do these podcasts.
I think the lack of professionalism is often helpful.
For sure.
Whether you're talking about Rogan, you know, I've watched many hours of Rogan over many years. And
good time to get some NeuroGum out?
much like a Marc Maron, who often seems underprepared.
Yes.
But because of the vibe that they've fostered in the room and because of the sort of naivete of the questioning and the windingness of the conversation, the unending, you know, this is not, we need to get our 15 minutes and you need to get out of here so we can get our next interview. This is, let's luxuriate in our shared lack of knowledge on various subjects.
Being lost together.
Yes. I think that that is an interview style that has taken over. And, you know, you're like, if that guy can do it, that guy doesn't really know anything. Like, I think Theo Von's lack of training and professionalism helps
him. It's an asset.
Yeah, it's an asset. And it gets more out of especially people who are wily and suspicious of journalists, frankly.
Right. And so the two that I was most fascinated by, weirdly, I probably haven't watched as much Rogan as you, but I was weirdly, I don't want to say let down, but I sort of felt like I could see all the moves coming with Rogan. But the two that I was most fascinated by structurally were Theo Von and Andrew Schultz. Andrew Schultz's show is the most like a conventional talk show. It's called Flagrant. He has a sidekick on his side. He's got two silent guys on the other couch flanking the guest. I was like, this must have been a nightmare for the Secret Service. He's got people on every angle blocking Trump. And Schultz is an incredibly polished stand-up, like rhythmically very polished. The thing about Theo Von is he is arrhythmia personified. Andrew Schultz is not. Andrew Schultz is very, very polished. But also because of that polish and because he's not particularly scared to go at controversial things, I felt like he was the person who was, of everyone, even more than Rogan, most willing to kind of like look Trump in the eye and kind of almost be like, this thing that you said is like, maybe it's BS, but like, I want to ask you about it anyway. And I thought that was interesting because I don't think anybody ever talks to Trump like that. But I think fundamentally, he wasn't trying to extract something politically from Trump that is not out of line with some of the other shows that we're talking about today. I was very, very struck because I thought he was very present and I thought he acknowledged Trump's foibles and then in a comedic way wove them into a sometimes serious line of questioning. Theo Von's interview does the exact opposite. Theo Von is truly, I did not know which neuron was going to fire next. And I think you saw this, like I also watched the Bernie Sanders episode. I also watched the J.D. Vance episode. They're all fascinating. And they're fascinating because if you're a career politician and you're used to conversations taking an expected line, you look at the person across from you, you know who they are, roughly know what their outlet is about, roughly know what they stand for, or what they're curious about. You're almost prepared to answer the question without even being there mentally. Theo Von's brain is moving in so many different directions and in an unstable way. And I think it forced people to soften their shoulders and answer, maybe, dare I say, truthfully in some places.
Yeah, I do wonder if there's a sort of misguided attempt to think, in fact, like, this is what we need to get more out of Trump. Like, if we want to be a mainstream media that engages with these type of figures, maybe we shouldn't be adversarial and we should present as friendly. And then that gives them plenty of rope, you know, that they can be comfortable with saying these things. But I think if then your goal is to hold them to account for the things that they say or the factual inaccuracies that come out in the process, I think like we've also seen that's
not happening.
Yeah, like there's no, it's not that Trump got so loose on these podcasts that then he said things that were then held against him. Like, I think
dispositional. Yeah. It's the dispositional thing that you don't usually see. It's not the substance and the policy.
And maybe it's audience, but I also think it's telling that Trump did how many of these interviews? A dozen?
Yeah, probably a dozen over the last 6 months.
Didn't seem to make a single gaffe in any of them that had any real burn in the mainstream media.
Right.
Like none of this, other than the fact of their existence, none of this became a news cycle in and of itself, in part because he's so inundated the world.
And there's so much
sound bites.
It's just,
but like, it's interesting that he didn't, it wasn't a trapdoor. It didn't prove, these places did not prove to be a trapdoor.
But also they weren't asking him about trapdoor things by and large. Like to hear the, I mean.
That's never stopped.
No, of course, fair. But it's like hearing Andrew Schills say the words, the Abraham Accord. I was like, what? Like that's very much an outlier moment in all of these shows. And Trump kind of runs roughshod. I mean, this happened with Aiden Ross for sure. This happened with the Bussin' with the Boys guys, where these are not people who are in a position to have a sophisticated political conversation. And so even just like bringing up a political topic, there's no, whatever Trump's going to say to them, leaning back into stump, is not going to be radically different than what he would say anywhere else.
We talked about this a bit last time we touched on this subject as far as the musicians and who was lining up behind Harris and who was lining up behind Trump and why. And I do wonder and think it's important to note that these people don't see what they're doing as journalism. They see what they're doing as content creation.
Yes, it's right. Exactly.
And Trump is primarily a content creator himself. And they see in him what they see in one another, which is good content.
And ratings.
And ratings. And they know that he and his world are a path to eyeballs.
Better ratings for them and paradoxically, great ratings for him.
And I think Aiden Ross paying Playboi Carti to show up on his stream is not really any different than Donald Trump. These are
than him buying Trump a Cybertruck.
Yeah, and these are both people who are going to send the view counter into the stratosphere, regardless of what they do. I mean, this is the other thing. It's like, even though Playboi Carti on Aiden Ross was a huge disaster, he got more burn out of it being a disaster. Than he would have if he just had a normal conversation with him. So I think there is
Presidential Medal of the Arts for Playboi Carti. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Eventually.
If we have something to do with that.
And it's interesting because all of this dovetails with another event that happened over the weekend, which is not actually Trump culture in any explicit way, but the fight between Jake Paul and Mike Tyson, live on Netflix, however many dozens of millions of viewers, more than the World Series, I'm sure, more than the NBA Finals, I'm sure. And that is the same strain, like that making its way to becoming the marquee pop sporting culture event, and sporting event of the month, the year, whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's the same current in culture, even if it's not explicitly right wing.
Yeah, I was texting with our colleague Jacob Gallagher. He went to ComplexCon this weekend. We pray for Jacob and a safe and speedy return. And I'll read you the text because I was texting with him about like a certain kind of streamer bro, and I won't name who he was talking about. But I was just like, yeah, there's a whole generation of famous dudes whose lives are activation to activation, tussle to tussle. And that to me feels like, you know, Jake Paul is potentially the inventor of that guy.
Right.
Starting as like a relatively harmless YouTuber, leaning into pranks, leaning into
controversy.
Like, yeah, leaning into controversy, turning into both a mogul, also someone whose primary public facing thing is monetizing violence. Right. And that being absolutely emblematic of everything that we are seeing now bubble up from this part of the media sphere. And I guess, did you see Paul Tyson both as that and also some weird like microcosm of like the Trump era officially vanquishing like the Clinton and Obama eras? Or is that too dark and also too deep?
Talk me through that a little bit.
Like, obviously, like, you look at Mike Tyson, you look at this man who on his best days would absolutely like wipe the floor with Jake Paul. Like, absolutely no question to me.
Sure.
But being kind of like stubborn and rigid and saying, I'm going to hold on. I still wish to prove myself. I still feel like I have a message that people need to hear. Even if that message is that you do not need to have a legacy and you say it to like a 13-year-old interviewer and that we all die and end up as dust, which, you know, real spit. But and then Jake Paul saying, number one, your history, Mike Tyson, your history, your legacy, that's real, but also means nothing to me. You know what also means nothing to me? Boxing's like sense of decorum, the sweet science, any of this, like none of that means anything to me. I simply wish to go out, be driven out in like a hydraulic car, wag my tongue at you and walk home with $40 million for taking like the softest of punches, the softest of beatings. Like, is that not reflective of a larger sea change in the type of culture that we are going to be seeing moving forward?
I think it's all reality television. And in the same way that it's all wrestling, it's all reality television, it's all, that's like, it's content. It's not sport. It's not politics. Mm-hmm. It's content. Mm-hmm. And I think content can succeed or it can fail based on whatever valence people want to project onto it.
Yeah.
But I think.
What would Norman Mailer have done with Jake Paul and Mike Tyson?
He would have written the crap out of it. You know, like he just like that, that's.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that if anything, it's about a posture. And I think the posture that people want in their art, for lack of a better term.
Is art still permitted?
Hear what I'll say. In their entertainment.
Has art not been banned in 2025?
I think what people want in their entertainment is a sense of fearlessness.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what they see in Trump and what we're likely to see in the work that comes out in this next Trump administration is, if not a total fearlessness, then like a gesture towards it.
Okay. So I have two, I think as we tie up this messy package, there's two potential directions that will probably coexist, right? But to what you were talking about, like, I do think about the resurgence of Lil Pump as like a political meme figure. And Lil Pump had a number of SoundCloud hits in like, what was it?
What was the number, two or three?
Do not denigrate the work of Lil Pump and Smoke Purp.
I like as two or three went, of those songs.
As someone who went on the first No Jumper tour, you know, I was there.
Yeah, you opened, right?
I still have all the tattoos. You know, someone who was there at the ground level. It was a fascinating thing to watch in real time. And then hip hop moved away. The main characters of that scene died of drug overdoses primarily or worse. And you would think, oh, Pump, someone like Lil Pump would just, that's it, consigned to the dustbin. And no, what he did is he remade himself as like a social media punching bag with Jake Paul, quite literally a punching bag, taking a punch from him. And then a meme coin, right wing MAGA shill who also spoke at a Trump rally. What spoke is, you know, strong word, but, you know, present at a Trump rally, Lil Pimp. And that was shocking. And again, from the outside looking in, you think, oh, that's, well, that'll never, you know, it's like the last gasp again. And no, now it's actually quite this. I think he's going to have another 10 or 15 years of something on the back of all this. I saw a TikTok.
Kid rocking up and down the block.
Yeah. I mean, I saw a TikTok of him in Dubai the other day, like some rich TikTok guy took him to Loro Piana and like got him suited out in Loro Piana. I was like, oh, like he's crossing into other spaces. Like it's going to be, he's going to end up with 10 or 15 more years of this. So you're going to have folks like that, whatever rappers coming in on the long tail of that, streamers, certainly streamer culture and podcaster culture. The other thing is I spent a lot of this weekend watching The English Teacher on FX Hulu. And this is a show about a gay English teacher in Texas. And half of it is like just regular punchline, like older generation, younger generation comedy. But every other episode is essentially about a hot button issue. Like there's one about what is the assigned reading and the kids cheating. One is about gun culture. And it's all this kind of tension between quote unquote woke culture and also the pushback to woke culture. And then wait, and then each episode kind of like ties a little bow at the end and says, there's actually ways we can all get along. We talked before, you said you watched a little bit of the show. I wonder what you think of that as kind of like a sub rosa Trump 2.0 approach to allegedly centrist, allegedly mainstream comedy.
And that goes back to what I was saying about Hillbilly Elegy, where I felt like before it was like,
you're saying that The English Teacher is like the Hillbilly Elegy.
I'm saying it's the update. it's the revamped version of what the left was trying to do then, which is like let's humanize them. We'll look at them anthropologically.
Yes.
And now it's a little more.
Let's weave it in.
Like the culture clash is actually fertile ground for comedy, and it's what we deal with on a daily basis. It's what it's like when you have a family dinner on Thanksgiving, and some people are.
It's all in the family.
Yeah, exactly, and it goes back to that. And I do think there's a little bit more, not reaching across the aisle, but like, let's laugh at ourselves and laugh at you and agree that, like, regardless of who's in office, we have to coexist in these spaces, in our offices, in our gyms, in our at our family dinners. And I think, you know, there, as far as it goes on the left, like, maybe it goes way into hope and escapism, maybe it goes into
blue sky
nihilism and darkness. I was listening over the weekend to our friend Sean Fennessy on The Big Picture,
hey boo,
talking about the Oscar race, and he and his guests reminded me that not long after Trump's first election in 2016 was the La La Land Moonlight Oscars early the next year. And that sort of standing in for, you know, and the Academy voters basically breaking 100 years of tradition to say, no, now Moonlight is best picture, not La La Land. It's Moonlight. And Moonlight won, and the way it won, obviously insane. But I think it's interesting to see how that's going to play out in this year's Oscar race or in this year's Grammy race. Like, do we, now is when we see Beyonce win her album of the year.
Andre.
for saying country music has black roots and that, now we have to galvanize ourselves by stamping this. Or are we about to live through the winter of Wicked where everyone's saying, no, we can't even deal with this. We're just going to slip into escape. And it's just going to be a fairy tale about how we should all get along. And the middle ground, I think, is something like The English Teacher or something like Post Malone. You know, I think he is our bipartisan hero at the moment because he's both a collaborator of Young Thug and a collaborator of Blake and Church and Wallen and whoever else you want to throw in that bucket.
I guess to my final note is, one thing that I've been quite surprised by is how ungalvanized people seem.
Right.
You think about 2017, the obviously protests and the constant pushback to an emergent Trump agenda. And I don't want to say people are being conciliatory, although, you know, Joe Biden welcoming him into the White House, that was read widely as like essentially a conciliatory gesture. You don't want to say that, but at the same time, that sense, that like big tent sense of outrage, it doesn't feel like that temperature is rising, which makes me think that that kind of culture maybe is not due for a comeback, but
it could be more collaborative.
Yes. And, you know, maybe we should go out with the song that is making Brian Jordan Alvarez, the star of The English Teacher, famous. It's actually, I would dare I say, it's less the content of the show, which is revealing in and of itself. I turned on this show. I was influenced by the memes. I watched the memes, 100 of them, and I was like, fine, I'll watch the show. And then the show was like, I was like, damn, this is way smarter. This is extremely smart. Very, very well executed show. But sometimes it takes a dumb thing to get people to watch a smart thing. So maybe let's go out with Ali Alexander's vibey Jason Mraz-y style record. It's called Breathe. That's our show. Every episode of Popcast is at nytimes.com/popcast. Our producers in the room is Maddie Maciello. And at home, it's Pedro Rosado from Meth Stepper Media. We will be back next week. You know I give me the good love and day.